Tom, welcome to Tech Sales Mentors AU. Thank you so much for giving us some time. Where does this podcast find you today?
It's sunny today. It's sunny, freshwater in Sydney.
And now you've taken the last 10 months or so as a break, your first in 20 odd years in tech. Could you talk about that recent experience and how it's been for you?
Yeah, it's been, I'd say, the most beautiful and challenging period of my life. The beauty was with the birth of my daughter Tilly, and just being able to experience largely the first year of her life, and have that time to really be present and enjoy just those micro moments. And for the parents out there, you can never predict when you're going to have that special micro moment. It's just time, you know, with your child. But you know, every day there'll be something, and it's just those small moments that you see in their development, or that, you know, a bonding moment that you have it's priceless, and it's so rewarding. And so, you know, that's been incredibly special for me. And also, I think being able to share that with my wife Tanya as well, where we can divide and conquer, if you like, and really sharpen as our best selves for Tilly. Where if someone's getting tired, we can swap out. So there's just that constant positive energy for her in her first year of her life, which is, you know, it's very unique. We're very you know, grateful to have that opportunity. But that's been a beautiful thing for us. And then on the challenging side, it's probably twofold. One, becoming a dad. I think all males probably go through this shift where you have to learn to put other people first and forget about your old life and the way you existed, and really, really put that behind you. Stop holding on to it. So that was part one. And part two was stopping work, right? So I went from what was a really intense environment where I'm used to constant problem solving, meetings, and just running really fast, to suddenly quiet. And it's, you know, it's quiet. There's silence, right? There's no one coming to me with problems. There was not a lot of, I guess, intellectual stimulation, for me, you know, suddenly stopping work. And, I would say it was an interesting period because I found myself quite anxious and almost a little bit frustrated. And I didn't foresee that. I was thinking, okay, this is going to be great. I'm going to have this time. Life's just going to be perfect. But I actually found myself frustrated and then almost guilty as a result of that, because I'm like, wait a minute, I've got it all here. Why am I not, you know, completely happy? And I realized I was having somewhat of a mini identity crisis with just getting comfortable with who I am, no longer being kind of at the center of a company. And really, I'm a full-time dad, and you know, that's me, Tom in freshwater, walking down the street with a pram. So it was a big adjustment, and one that I hadn't probably seen, foreseen what that would look like. But at the same time, that's also been rewarding, having to kind of really confront that head on and go pretty deep within myself.
Talk to me about that realization. How long was it until you were able to switch off and realize these micro moments, and what was it that aided you in that discovery?
Yeah, probably I would say 3 months. I'd say 3 to 4 months. Was the, let's call it, the unwind period. And then not just unwinding, also kind of recognizing what was happening for me personally. So, and I'd probably equate it to, sorry, you go for it.
Where did that come from, that realization? Was it you kind of white knuckling it as to what's going on here, or were you reading certain things, talking to people? Where did that realization come from as to the identity?
Chats with my wife, I think I was observing, like, she was watching me trying to latch onto these side projects where I was I was looking for a bone to chew on, basically. And she goes, you just like, yeah, throw myself into like permaculture, which is, you know, sustainable farming. And I was like, just in that deep, and, you know, doing like mini workshops and that sort of thing. And she's like, hey, like, you know, we're like, I get you're looking for something to get into, but you know, that's not the main event. And it was always exercise, but I was just, you could see, that I was looking for something to really throw myself at, to probably ease the landing of suddenly going from this intense environment to, you know, what is, you know, a fairly quiet environment on a day-to-day basis. So, yeah, it was probably Tanya who called out or observed, my behavior. And then from there, I started to kind of just explore that thinking and chat with a few people, which also helped me round it out. That had probably been in my shoes and explained, you know, a little bit more of what might be going on for me. Yeah.
No doubt. And it sounds like it is an evolutionary principle. You used to running fast, finding something to be anxious about, something to go and conquer, and find that problem to solve. When you don't have that, find something to be anxious about. You know, in my experience as well, you think that you go sit on the beach and you're going to have the greatest time, and you find something to be anxious about. That's nature. Relentless people like yourself. So that's why I primed this question. I probably set you up for it to an extent. I would have known looking at your profile that was going to be a difficult time for you, at least initially. Yeah. And it's really interesting to hear about that. See if you've had.
Yeah, no, you're spot on, and it definitely was. And I think I'd summarize it as it's almost like you need the intellectual stimulation. That's the bit that boredom's not the right word, because raising a child is not boring. It's beautiful and it's amazing, and it's different, and they actually open up your eyes to maybe some of the little things you weren't seeing on a day-to-day basis. But it's definitely, I think it's the intellectual stimulation of problem solving and so on that you start to search for a little bit and can cause a little bit of anxiety when it's not there.
So you mentioned this identity that you're aware of. What does that mean for you now moving into the next role? Because no doubt it'll be a matter of time before you are back in that world. Yeah. Have you learned anything as to how to approach the next business opportunity?
Yeah, so you know, it's for me, it was really interesting just to have this time out. One, I was really curious to see if I still had the hunger and the desire, because my previous roles that have been intense, that they are all in type roles, and you know, often when people take these breaks, they think, okay, well, I'm now just, you know, going to have this time out, and maybe I'll start to do a little bit of consulting or advisory work, or you know, see what's next. But for me, I found just organically within myself, I still had that hunger, that desire for something that's intense. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to run fast. So it was good to feel that within myself and not do it because someone thinks I should or because I'm still young, whatever the case may be. And then in terms of what that looks like for me, I think the next chapter is very much about meaning and purpose. Protocol was incredibly rewarding in terms of, you know, the impact on the construction industry. When I think about the next chapter, I really look at, you know, the climate crisis that we're facing. And I think about green technology or climate technology and the role that can play. And so that's probably the theme that I'm looking at. I've been chatting with a few people, and it's very much an emerging space. A lot of really exciting startups, really interesting technology that I truly think is going to be impactful and meaningful, increasingly so as governments start to realize that they're way behind the eight ball in terms of the amount of action that they need to be taking to get us out of what is a pretty bad situation. So that excites me, but I'd say very much meaning and purpose, and that's something that I'm personally interested in, that I think will be a theme in the next chapter.
How much of your daughter's birth too has inspired that next move?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's definitely a part of it. I think it was always a theme for me when people say, oh, so what would you do if it wasn't protocol? You know, what would you do next? That was always a theme for me, but I think it's definitely accelerated it. And I'm probably now starting to really zoom into, okay, everyone talks about net zero 2050, but it's probably more a question of like, well, how are we actually going to get there? And And then what's the role that technology is playing to actually put a serious dent in this net zero target to get there? And yeah, I very much want to, hopefully, you know, I leave this earth in a place where I feel confident about, you know, my daughter's future and humanity. If I can play some small role in that journey that I think we all have to go on, then that's super meaningful and satisfying.
What's your take on the industry at large that you just mentioned, and how do we marry the two? So the impact and the opportunity to make a difference, how do we marry that with the super competitive, hard capitalist, progressive industry that is software? You built Procore here in Australia from a few people to be, you know, a huge business. Procore, you know, just turned over $1 billion in annual revenue just last year. Mm. How far away are we from businesses in the industry that you mentioned being able to do that? Do you see that being something that could translate and we could get there quicker via that model?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think to just answer your question outright, I think we're 12 to 14 months off the marrying of, let's call it, SaaS skills, moving into green tech. And I think if you speak with the founders of some of these green tech companies, there is an awareness there that they need to think about scale. They need to accelerate. I think the VCs absolutely have the appetite for growth to your point. But it's crossing that bridge. And, at the same time, you know, these founders, they're small business owners, and it's risk appetite as well. And it's venturing into a world that maybe they don't have a lot of exposure to, where I do, and as do my peers, where we can see the opportunity. If we could marry it up, I think there's an incredible growth journey there for us. And I think the timing is now. I think it's right. It's just, how do we build up that appetite and also confidence to see how the two can be married together to really go on a pretty meaningful growth journey. And the sentiment I get is we're probably 12 to 14 months off that kind of next phase of acceleration, where you really see, call it, top talent coming in from, say, different backgrounds, like the SaaS industry, that starts to set up that growth journey.
And what will likely move the needle most quickly? Is it VC and PE firms realizing the potential gains from investing in these companies?
I think so, and I think there already is quite a lot of investment, but I think it's now, okay, well, how do we grow these companies from, you know, what might be sub 10, $20 million businesses today to $100 million, billion businesses tomorrow? And what does that growth journey look like? And actually really looking at, okay, well, what's the investment that's required? What does the headcount look like? What does the talent look like to facilitate that growth journey? And so it's just stepping out of what is already a successful start, and getting to 10 million is always hard. And so there's a lot to be proud of there, but to truly make an impact, and to deliver that the growth that we're talking about, there's a quantum leap that needs to happen. And that's where I think VCs, PE can play a big role in helping place talent and encourage the right talent into those organizations and help shift the paradigm, where everyone feels ready to go on that journey.
It's a great point you make about being ready and the SaaS talent. So I speak to people in SaaS sales often, and they'll say, hey, if something comes up in renewables tech, tell me about it. I'm really interested. That's the place I want to be. But there's going to be some time where those people are able to match their earning potential, which is important to people in SaaS, of course, particularly sales, that industry is going to match that earning potential. And it's whether the opportunity for impact is going to balance out that potential hit, at least in the short term, in conversation. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Do you feel if you were starting a business in that sector and you were the CEO or head of growth, you would be looking to go and find those people and be talking to them about making greater impact and maybe taking a smaller haircut on their compensation if they're able to?
Yeah, absolutely. I would be willing to do that. And you're spot on. It's, you know, if you think about it from the other side, from the founder's point of view, it's like, I'd really understand the value, and they might be aware, okay, we need to think about our sales organization, go to market. But if you're coming from a product or policy background to suddenly understanding, you know, how do I put together a commercial team? Like, what does this look like? There is quite a big leap there, and truly understanding the value. So you're willing to assign an appropriate budget to attract these people. I think it's got to work both ways, where the SaaS talent are willing to maybe take a small haircut to start in a really new and exciting space that has, I think, a wonderful growth opportunity. And on the flip side, the founders probably also taking a leap of faith as well to invest in talent that they may not completely understand yet, but that can be truly valuable for their organizations.
It's an interesting point. Yes, we perhaps take for granted how well SaaS companies look at sales and the sales and marketing budget and sales professionals, and being part of that is just, you know, you don't need to ask a CEO of a SaaS company whether they should be paying SaaS salespeople the right amounts.
That's right.
Other industries, I need some education. Who will play the role of educating those businesses? Is it the place of the new incumbent CRO, new CRO that could come in and have that advisory? Is it the VCs who will be the job?
Yeah, I think it's probably a combination of both. I think ideally CROs, they can play a huge role, particularly if they come from that SaaS background. And I do know of a CRO that's doing exactly that at a climate tech company. Where he said it was quite a big challenge initially with the C level and truly getting them across the line on why it matters and why the payback model is significant if you get it right. But then I think it's also on the VCs and private equity companies to push as well. On what is the growth story? What does it look like, and how are you going to get there? And also helping, because presumably within their portfolio, a lot of them would already have exposure to your traditional SaaS company where the model's proven, and there could be a lot of best practice sharing.
Absolutely. So let's talk about best practice for those who aren't aware of the Procore journey. So you joined in 2018. There was a small handful of staff in Sydney, no office at that time. Over the five-year period, you scaled the business to circa 180 staff and positioned the brand, which was a challenger at that time, as a market leader in the APAC region. Procore listed in 2021 and recently surpassed $1 billion in global annual revenue. Quite a story. How do you reflect upon the success of that journey?
Yeah, it was an incredible journey, one I'm very thankful to have gone on. I think to summarize it a little bit, we had a really unique opportunity to make a big impact on the construction industry. So that was, and do it in a really positive way. Like it's not disruptive technology. It's technology that's going to add value day one, and deliver, you know, great outcomes, for the industry. And I think everyone on the team could see that. And so that excited the people that were working for Procore and created a real sense of belief that we could make a big difference. But it was also our customers too, particularly our early customers, that were just incredible partners to us in helping educate us on the industry, particularly in Australia, and how do we deliver the best possible technology platform for them that actually solves the challenges that are top of mind for them. So that was a great education journey, but also a really meaningful partnership that delivered good outcomes over that period. I think the other aspect of it was that culture was a really big theme for us as well. So from day one, we were very big on our core values of openness, optimism, and ownership. And and invested in that heavily. So that really defined the way we treated each other internally at Procore, how we treated our customers, how we partnered, and we rewarded people and recognized based on those core values. We also hired on those core values, which helped keep the culture consistent over that period of time. So something that I'm very proud of, but I think it's the team that should be really proud of it, because ultimately they owned it. Every individual within the APAC business took ownership of culture and became custodians of our culture day one. I think the other bit from once that cultural base was formed, was then inspiring people to go do the best work of their lives. And that was really about going above and beyond your job description. And initially, you know, when you start to talk like that, people are like, okay. I'll do my best. But when individuals actually go and do it, and you can see how it's impacted a customer experience, or it's improved the go-to-market model, or it's a new use case that the product can meet, and then you highlight and recognize that people see that, they take note of that, and then they want to go to a whole new level within their role, and that created a bit of a tribal effect across the business, which was really exciting, because you then have this buzz and this energy, and over the top of that, you know the impact you're making on the industry. You know you got this big task, but it's so meaningful if you can execute on it, and that created this very special environment, and we delivered some really great outcomes in building a $100 million business in Australia, really high employee engagement and great customer satisfaction as well. But I would still bring it back to the people. It's always about the people, and I was very lucky to work with the people I did in region, and it was a pretty special place for that period of time.
No doubt. And it sounds like a really high performance culture, a very engaged workforce. Well, I understand that that was something you actually pulled data from. I know you used to assess engagement of the staff year on year, which is pulling data out. Were there any things that you learned from those 5 years as to staff engagement balanced with performance? Any things that came from staff engagement that made you make certain decisions? How useful was tracking that user engagement of your own staff?
Yeah, it was really good. It was that feedback and the data. You don't always want to hear it, right? You're thinking, because you're working so hard to deliver the best possible environment, and then sometimes you see this feedback. But what I found particularly whether you agree with it or not, it's that someone's perspective or perception of the company, of the culture, and it's important to go and understand that. So often what we'd do is we'd use the data to like go on a listening tour and put together mini groups to, if we felt there's a blind spot or something that wasn't quite hitting the mark, we would then act on it and go do a listening tour first before we acted, because we want to truly understand the problem statement, if you like. And once we understood the problem statement, we could then go, okay, well, here's the action plan that needs to take place off the back of that. So, and so you could specifically target, and the data, like you saw the top three themes in terms of what's going really well, and then you also saw the top three areas for improvement. And so off the back of those top three areas for improvement, you could then drill into the commentary as well around those top three areas that people usually put in anonymously, which was fine by me. And then from there, we could do the listening tours. And so a lot of it, there was definitely themes in tech, was around shifting the gender balance, empowering women in the workplace, and making sure that women had a voice in meetings, and so better facilitation skills, but also helping develop some of the women within the company as well to have more confidence to speak up, to be more assertive. So there was, I guess, a multi-pronged effort there to create let's call it a safer environment, but one that thrived and built confidence for women to speak up. And that was a theme that through really listening and understanding and being able to pinpoint exactly where the gaps were or where the potential isolation was happening in meetings, that we're able to put together a program that I really felt addressed that. And it's cool because on the flip side, the Procore employees could see us investing directly in feedback that they had provided to us to, you know, improve the culture and take it to that next level.
Absolutely. And an added outcome of that, no doubt, as a employer brand, very much one of the best companies to work for in SaaS in Australia. So obviously a found market, and there were lots of people that wanted to come and work for you and be on that journey. How did the profile of the type of people that you initially hired in those first few months versus the latter years of when you were running a bigger company, did the type of profile person that you hired change, or were the values and the skill set the same?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I would say that the themes when we started out were smart, humble, hungry. That actually remained consistent all the way throughout, where we wanted people that were smart, they were a quick study. Humble was super important to Procore regardless of our success. We wanted to make sure that we never became arrogant or as a result complacent, always open to listening to the customer, listening to our partners, listening to those around us. And then hungry, just having that desire, that drive to do better, to keep going, to better serve our customers. So that was a consistent theme throughout. Something that was probably a little bit more unique early on was looking for that entrepreneurial spirit. As you'll know, with startups, or when we're effectively a startup, when we first launched in Australia, you're wearing so many different hats. And so whilst you might have a job description, if you box yourself into that job description, you're probably not going to be successful early on, because you're going to be saying, no, that's not my job, or I don't do this, when that's just not the reality when you're launching. Everyone's usually wearing multiple hats. So those that have that entrepreneurial spirit or even entrepreneurial background seem to thrive, and it worked well. Where it just didn't faze them. They were ready to take it on. They'll be ready to, you know, go outside their job description, and they could see what needed to be done on a daily basis. So that was definitely a theme. I'd say the in terms of hiring, there's a combination of tech and construction backgrounds. We're probably a little bit too heavy on tech initially, because it turned out that those with construction backgrounds are really the enablement team that we had for those with tech backgrounds to bring everyone up to speed on the construction industry, which was super important. And so we started to, I'd say, through the course of my journey there, that definitely was a bit of a yo-yo effect, where then we went heavier on construction folks and then it would go back to tech. But we balanced it out to make sure that we did have the right balance and right distribution, which was really important in terms of product development, enablement, and just overall customer experience. And then probably the last one was just really looking for just good human beings that you love to be around on a daily basis. It doesn't mean they have to be the exact same profile as you, but it's just good people that you're excited to work with, that get you through the tough days. It just makes those tough days that little bit easier. As we shifted into, you know, like 22, 23, I'd say the operational rigor went to, you know, a whole new level. And it naturally, as you start to grow up, you start to really look to improve the operational rigor and just focus and make sure you got the 101 in place. It's important. Where we started to look for just a bit more experience, those that had, you know, been there and done the roles, rather than say some of those entrepreneurs that maybe were like growing up within Procore. So that's where the hiring profile shifted a little bit, but it didn't change too dramatically over that time.
You mentioned growing up in a, prior to Procore, of course, you had a fantastic career with Salesforce. How important and influential was has Salesforce been on your career at large today?
Yeah, huge. Salesforce, I'm just incredibly thankful to have gone on what was a 12-year journey there with them. They gave me the B2B SaaS playbook. I think Salesforce pretty much built the playbook for you know, business-to-business SaaS companies. And I was very lucky to just have a lot of great mentors at Salesforce as well that not only taught me, I guess, the art of selling, but also, you know, they gave me the management playbook, and then they taught me how to be a great senior leader. There's just a lot of investment in development, learning and development, and then having people around you that had just such incredible careers themselves, had the experience, the knowledge, and were willing to give you their time to help you from, or help me in this case, from, you know, making short side decisions or making some rookie errors, you know, so early on in my leadership journey was really valuable. And it just gave me the fundamentals that, you know, are very much still applied to this day. So yeah, really thankful. And I think it's interesting when I speak with a lot of Salesforce people that had left the company, the common theme is I didn't realize how much knowledge I had acquired during that time that I can now pass on to my next company, which will be really valuable. They just assume that every company is operating like that, which isn't the case. But yeah, super meaningful on multiple levels.
Yeah, that experience at Salesforce has been enduring, and so many of the SaaS companies that were headed up in APAC by Salesforce alumni, and they're just everywhere, right? And they're creating great people. So it's brilliant that what they're producing over there. It's easy to look at your career from a high level, from a high view, say, what a fantastic career. But over those 21 years, there'd have been plenty of struggles, challenges, decisions that you'd have had to make on a weekly, daily basis to get where you are today. And you're obviously not finished yet. There's still plenty to do. But could you, if you could bottle it and make, you know, make it succinct, what are the, you know, key decisions that you've made over the year? What are the key decisions, sorry, that have driven you to the place where you are today?
Yeah, so a big question. I'll try and be succinct as possible. I think, from a young age, this is going back to like me being really young and just observing my parents. My parents moved out from South Africa, started with nothing, worked extremely hard to give my brother and I just an amazing life in Australia. And so just watching them do what they did, I guess it's always inspired me and given me a belief that, well, I've been given the ultimate springboard in life. I can go do whatever I want to with enough hard work and focus. So that is probably just an underlying theme that has existed. And when you talk about drive or being driven, that's probably where it comes from. And that's been really important in my 21 years. It is the drive. It's how you show up each day. And it's that you've got to get up and go and show up as your best self. I'd say in terms of influences and decisions, it's also having incredible mentors. And I think that's really helped me when I have had to make a big decision where, you know, my 12 years, even at Salesforce, there was a situation where I didn't get the leadership role that I really felt I deserved. And I was still young at the time, and I was looking to take my first step into leadership, and I'd made Chairman's Club and been a top performer, and the person I was up against, was all 6 months in the business, but had prior management experience, and he got the role. And so it was this junction where I was like, wait a minute, what's my future at Salesforce? And, you know, I'm glad that I actually spoke and sat down with a couple of my mentors to go through the scenario rather than throwing the toys out of the pram and saying, all right, well, I'll go work for SAP or someone else. And And they said how you respond to this will define your career, how you respond to knockbacks and being rejected. That will demonstrate, you know, your strength of character and whether you're ready for that leadership role. And it was just great advice because I just hung in there and end up, you know, 6 months later, an opportunity presented itself and it was actually a more senior leadership role straight off the bat. So it worked out quite well for me. But I would say just having those mentors as a sounding board is so important, and they're not always easy to find, but it providing you're willing to make the investment as an individual, it can really serve you well in your career because it's super important, I think, as an individual contributor, but it's just as important as a leader where, particularly a junior leader, where you don't have all the answers and you're going to be put in situations where it's difficult conversations or decisions that you have to make, where if you can bounce that off someone that's been there and walked in your shoes, more often than not, they're going to give you great advice that will help you from making a mistake or going down the wrong path. And, you know, I've a lot of thanks for my mentors because I think they helped me accelerate my career at quite a young age and helped mature me and put me in the right position. But it was their guidance that was crucial to, I guess, you know, my success. And then probably the other themes as I think about the last 21 years is just holding yourself to a standard and really showing up as your best self. It does take a lot. It takes a lot personally. It's in some ways you've got to be quite selfish to be able to show up as your best self every day because you always got to put other people first in the workplace. But that does take a toll on your personal life. But I think it's important. And then you know, also I think being vulnerable as well, you don't have to know it all. And I think when you initially start out as a leader, you feel like you got to add value and you got to demonstrate your value versus as you get a little more experienced, being vulnerable builds trust, builds openness, which ultimately builds engagement. And that can result in, you know, better outcomes than having to be the smartest person in the room all the time.
Yeah, fantastic. And the next question I wanted to ask you is with a view to giving advice to a salesperson that's starting their career or maybe perhaps in their early years. And I want to take a couple of things you just mentioned. So on the first part, mentorship, another enduring legacy of Salesforce, another large successful companies is there is a real network of people that are high performers and willing to give their wisdom and advice. I often am asked by salespeople getting into the industry, should I join a startup? Knowing what you know now, if it was the start of your career, would you opt to work for a larger established business like a Salesforce, or would you have opted for a Procore first in, you know, first time in region if it was your first couple of roles?
It's a really it's a really tough question. Because I can see pros and cons on both sides, but I think if you're playing the long game, I would say go for the more established organization. One, it will come down to resource around learning and development, enablement, and having the right people in place to where they actually have the time. In a startup environment, it is a little bit fend for yourself, learn on the job, go. There's not necessarily that hand holding around you or the same level of learning and development that more established companies would have. So I think in terms of building your foundation that sets you up for the future, I would say go for the larger company initially just to get your playbook in place, build your foundation, and then from there you might look at, you know, a tech startup or something that's going to be running a lot faster, a lot leaner, but you've already got your base set of skills that will serve you well in that potentially higher paced environment where there's not as much assistance. But yeah, because there's always the temptation of the equity, the explosion, being first in the door. But I think if you're just starting out, go for the more established company initially.
Yeah, great. Good advice. And the second part, you mentioned being able to switch off at the start of the conversation and how difficult that was, the selfishness involved in really keeping yourself disciplined and pushing yourself to your own personal best. When we talk about taking a break, is it something that, like you've done, you build up some currency and then you take a longer period, you know, once you've achieved a certain level of success in the industry? Is it something that you can do more frequently and take small breaks? Do you feel that you do have that opportunity to take your foot off the gas if you want to reach your full potential as a VP in sales?
Yeah, it's I would say just as a theme, balance is really important, and you've got to find that routine, that weekly routine that gives you that balance. And you know, for a lot of people, that's exercise. For others, it's more focus on headspace, which might be, you know, meditation, breathing, to just help you unwind and then get you ready for that next day. I think whatever it is, I won't define for people, you know, what it should be, but whatever it is, you need to have that, almost that weekly routine that helps you show up as your best self. And then in line with that, I do believe in downtime. I would definitely recommend quarterly breaks. They don't need to be long breaks, but just something that gives you even 4 days, it depends on what phase that company is in. And if it's all hands on deck and you got to go, you might only be able to get, you know, 3-4 days out before you just got to be back in the business. And, but even that, just that short period of time and making sure you plan that and doing that on a quarterly basis can really serve you well and just give you that opportunity to recharge, switch off and help you be at your best. Cause that's what it's about. It's about being at your best, being showing up as your optimal self. And if you're not taking that time out, I think at some point you start to blame the company for your stress, whatever other pressure points you might be facing in your life, when it's actually not the company's fault. That's on you. You got to manage your time, set your boundaries and figure out what's going to help you be at your best. In terms of taking a big break, I wouldn't recommend that early on in the career, in your career. I think you got to get after it. You got to put the hard yards in to fly high. But I do think, you know, you essentially you earn the right at a certain point where if you just feel deep down, you want to take that time out. It might be for a personal event, might be you feel the need to recharge, whatever the case may be. It could be a tragedy as well, whatever the case may be. By all means do that. But I think it's, to answer your question, it's probably more around smaller, regular breaks to keep you fresh, unless you're talking about significant tenure, and then a larger break may be justified.
Great advice. Tommy, you've been an absolutely fantastic guest, so much wisdom, and you've been really good to us in giving us your time. So thank you very much. It'd be great for all the account executives and sales leaders listening today, and we'll be there'll be a lot of people looking forward to seeing your next move. What can we expect from you next over the next 6-12 months, do you expect?
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see where I land, but as I mentioned, I'm excited about the green tech space. So and back to meaning and purpose, it's definitely going to have that. And excited to sink my teeth into that next chapter, and my hope is attract and bring great people on the journey and go be successful. So time will tell, but stay tuned. I am fired up for that next chapter.
Really exciting. Wish you all the best, and thank you very much again, Tom.
Thanks, Ranjo. Really appreciate your time too.